Oh, yes, such a joyous piece of music, and most appropriate, of course, for this Easter weekend, today being Good Friday, and Easter Sunday, the resurrection, and that's what that piece is all about. Now, it is Easter, it's Good Friday afternoon. Gareth McRae and Keith Baker with you this afternoon. For the next couple of hours, we're going to be talking in general terms about Easter. As a by way of a general introduction, Easter commemorates, obviously, the death and resurrection of Christ. It's considered to be the oldest feast within the Christian faith. The name comes from the Anglo-Saxon goddess of spring, Eostre. Her festival was celebrated at this time of year. Now, the variation of dates each year is a result of the decision of the Council of Nicaea in 325 AD that Easter be observed on the Sunday following the first full moon after the vernal equinox. The date can fall any time between March 21 and April 25. I might add that the Eastern Orthodox Church stipulates that it must be held after the Jewish Passover. Taken together, Lent, Easter Sunday, the Ascension, followed by Whitsun, cover more than 90 days in the Christian calendar. Celebrating each of these periods of a larger Easter season brings a very special blessing to each of us. Easter Sunday is the culmination of Holy Week. Easter commemorates, as I said, the resurrection of Christ. It's the most important Christian festival and the one celebrated with the greatest joy. The Easter story is at the heart of Christianity. Now, to talk about Easter, as I said, I'm joined by Reverend Keith Baker, one of the many wonderful ministers at St. Paul's Anglican Church in Castle Hill. Keith, good morning. Afternoon, I should say.
Good afternoon, Gareth. Great to be with you.
Now, tell me, how did the services go this morning, Good Friday?
Very well. People love to gather. As you were saying, it's a significant day. It's a holy day. And it was a great opportunity to remember Christ's death on the cross. Obviously, that's the first part of the equation. We'll remember the resurrection on Sunday, so we get a two-part deal. But it was a great time of celebrating, and I guess a somber reflection at the same time as a celebration when we think about why it is that Christ went to the cross.
Mm. For someone who may be listening to you right now who isn't a normal church attender, why is Easter so important?
Yeah, well, Easter is what Christmas is aiming at. So we love to celebrate Christmas, and there's something about babies that we really like. But certainly as Christ grew up, his understanding of his mission, that is the reason that he came to earth, was actually to come to die and to rise again. So it's interesting, if you look through the Christian documents, particularly something like the Gospel of Mark, the like a biography of Jesus, Jesus predicts his own death and resurrection three times. And that's significant. Three times is not an accident. Three times is a deliberate prediction. And he says his death is going to be purposeful. It's going to bring about a new set of circumstances in relationships between people and God. And so Easter, I guess, is the celebration of Christ fulfilling the purpose of his life.
Yeah. I've often been mystified as to the term Good Friday when, in fact, he dies on Friday. Mm. Why is it called? What's the significance of that word good?
Well, good in terms of the what that death affects, what reality that brings about. So, as we said, Jesus predicted his death, and he said that his death would be a ransom for many. He would give his life as a ransom for many. So it's some sort of payment. And if you explore that throughout the rest of the scriptures, what he's actually saying is that his perfect life is going to be paid to free those who have imperfect lives. He's going to bring about a status of righteousness or cleanness of people before God by offering his perfect holy life in their place. So it's a substitution of his life for others, and because that is what his death is all about, that's why his death is good. That's why we celebrate and call it Good Friday.
Okay. Christmas, one huge celebration for the Christian church. Easter, another huge celebration for the Christian church. Often in the season of either Christmas or Easter, we focus on just that season.
Yeah.
To what extent is it important that you see both celebrations together as one story?
Yeah, well, I think it is important. And the poet by the name of Steve Turner wrote a great poem. You can Google it, saying the cast of Christmas reassembles for Easter, and they talk about the crib, the manger is. They take the wood apart and they assemble a cross out of it, and all that sort of stuff. And the point that he's making there, in a very artistic way, is that the two are intrinsically linked. You can't separate them, or to separate them is artificial. Mm. That is Jesus, God come to earth in human flesh, is heading towards the cross the whole time, and so. That's why in a lot of the discussion about Christmas, we actually project forward to Easter when we're talking about Christmas at Christmas time in church.
Yeah. I'm talking to the Reverend Keith Baker from St. Paul's Anglican Church in Castle Hill, and a really nice man. And if you're ever looking for something special to do as way as a church, I urge you to go there this coming Easter Sunday very quickly. What time are the services?
We've got 8, 10, 5 and 7. All are welcome to all of them, of course. They've got different flavours. 8's a bit... more traditional flavoured in the contemporary styles throughout the rest of the day, but welcome to all of them.
I like that flavoured idea that brings the notion of Easter eggs, but we'll go there later.
Sure.
I'm a little confused. Last Sunday was Palm Sunday.
Yep.
Christ comes in on the back of a donkey and everyone's waving palms, everyone's happy, everyone's cheering, and then 4 or 5 days later, they're crucifying him. What happened?
Mm. Well, the riding in on the donkey is a fulfilment of Scripture. So the Scriptures... predicted forward in the book of Zechariah, they said, when God's great king, who's going to restore all creation to its rightful state, they're going to restore Israel to its rightful place amongst the nations and restore all creation to God, when that person comes, he's going to come on a donkey, on a colt of a donkey. And so Jesus asking his disciples to go and get the colt of a donkey is a direct fulfillment of that scripture. And so they hail him as Messiah, but what they want is a great king who's going to come and bring a military victory. Of course, at that time, Judea was occupied by the Romans and they had to pay taxes and all of those sorts of things, and no one likes being occupied. And so what they were hoping for was a great king would come and raise up an army, and God would be behind this king and boot the Romans out, and they'd have their own nation again. Mm. What Jesus is doing is he's saying, yes, I am the Messiah, and I am the great king that you're waiting for, but I'm not going to bring the great victory in the way that you think. And in fact, that's a paradox of all of the Gospels, that Jesus is able to do things that say he's the Messiah, this great king, and he repeatedly fulfills that prophecy and says, yes, I am that person. But he says, at the same time, I'm this other figure who's predicted in the Scriptures like Isaiah, who's the suffering servant, one who's going to come from God, who is going to give his life for the sins of others and bring them new life with God. So
they turned on him because he wasn't the military great king.
Exactly. And, of course, the religious heavies of the day, they despised him from much earlier on. So whilst the crowd were kind of celebrating him, that wasn't an opportunity where they could get to him. So they had to look for another opportunity. And so that's where you get the Garden of Gethsemane and the betrayal of Judas.
Sure.
And all that.
This may seem like a silly question. I don't mean it to be, given that it's all part of history now anyway. To what extent would things have been different if when he came in, they accepted him as the Messiah, not the military king, but accepted him? Would that still have meant there still had to be a death and resurrection?
It's an interesting question. We'll never know because it didn't happen that way. But the fascinating thing was Jesus predicted his death, as we said, several times, but he also predicted it to be at the hands of the religious establishment. In fact, it would be the Sanhedrin, the official governing body of the Jews, whose legal expertise was the envy of the world,
right,
who would miscarry justice and put him to death for blasphemy, for claiming that he was God. The irony is, of course, he was.
Mm.
So when Jesus came, when God came to earth as a person, it's the self-righteous who put him to death. You'd think it's an angry mob or something like that, or it was an accidental death on his way to do something good, but it was actually the respectable people who led him to the cross.
That makes sense, given that we've mentioned Christmas. He is born in Bethlehem, and I suppose, true to the song's title, Christ does go the distance. Would that be a fair...
He does, all the way to the cross.
Let's play the song. Said and be true of Jesus Christ. He certainly did go the distance. Gareth McRae with you on Alive 90.5. Reverend Keith Baker is our very special guest. We're talking about Easter. Keith, we've mentioned Christmas and we've mentioned Easter. We're not going to focus just on Christmas, of course. Christmas seems to have a whole lot of secular mythology surrounding it. Like there's Scrooge and there's Yes, Virginia, there's Santa Claus and there's Santa Claus and there's snow and all those sorts of things. Mm. But there seems to be not a complete, but almost a complete absence of that same kind of mythology around Easter. Why do you think that is?
Well, as I mentioned before, with Christmas, you have a little baby involved, and so it's easy to identify with a joy of a baby. I think that's part of a lot of people's experience, and so happy to celebrate a baby coming into the world. That's a nice thing, and the language of a baby coming in is that it's God's gift, and so we talk about gift giving, and there's and that's a nice thing to do as well. It's a very easy thing to adopt personally. When you get to Easter, you're talking about someone dying, which is not easy. That's not normally a joyous experience in anyone's life. And you're talking about a resurrection, both things...
But that's joyous, surely.
That is.
That's the great joy.
It is. It is the, ultimate joy. No, you're right. But you are faced with the questions of, well, a death is a sad thing, so how could we call it good, like we mentioned before? And you're confronted with the reason. And the death of Jesus proclaims that, you know what, humanity is not good at its core. It actually needs saving. And that's hard to kind of build a secular mythology around. We can talk about gift giving, and there's actually not a lot of threat to our personal identities, sure. Identities with that. The resurrection, of course, asks you to believe in something that's not part of our common experience. I haven't seen someone rise from the dead. I don't know if you have, Gareth.
No,
you might have
not recently,
out in different circles to me. So it asks you to believe in that, and there are good reasons for believing in that. But it's just that extra jump that's hard to build a secular mythology around. So the closest thing we've got is maybe Easter eggs and an Easter bunny. I don't know what the bunny has to do, particularly because bunnies don't lay eggs. Also, in my part of the world, I don't know if you've seen it.
But Eostre being the fertility, bunnies are very fertile.
They
you
certainly
put two
are.
Bunnies in a drawer and you're going to end up with a lot of bunnies.
Bunnies, but no bunny eggs. So, you know, the idea of new life is involved with an egg and that sort of stuff. And so typically there's the explanation, and Christians are happy to sort of take that idea of an egg and saying there's new life there. But that's about as close as you can get.
You use the word faith in that. And now Paul in his in various letters, he talked about faith, hope and love.
Yes.
What does faith mean, and how do you lock into it?
Sure. Well, faith's got it's one of those words, I think, that has got away in most people's understanding from its kind of true meaning. Faith is just trust, and you're exercising faith right now in your chair. Because when I'm looking at you, you are sitting in your chair, you're not standing up. You're exercising faith in your chair, and I know you are because you're sitting on it. If you didn't trust that the chair would hold you up, you wouldn't sit on it. And faith, I exercise faith in my wife when we made promises to each other when we got married, and I said, I'm going to trust you to keep your promise. And it's like that with God. You trust the promises of God that he makes to us through Jesus and through all that Jesus does at Easter. You say, Jesus' death claims to be for me, to bring me to God, to reconnect me to God, to wipe away my sin, so I can have a relationship with the God who made me, and I'm going to trust in that. I'm not going to trust in my own effort. I'm not going to trust in anything else. I'm going to put my trust in that, and that trust will flow forth into action that demonstrates that trust.
Okay, without looking at what the pragmatists would argue, I can show you evidence that Julius Caesar was a real character in history. I can show you evidence that Napoleon Bonaparte. I can show you the Sydney Harbour Bridge. I can give you physical things to show you that doesn't necessarily require you to underpin it with a faith, because you can give evidence. We're talking about the Easter story, and we obviously want people to accept something that we believe was part of history.
Yes.
How do we know?
Yes. Good question. And the great thing about that is that we know through the same tools that any historian would know anything in the past. So there's lots of testimony to Jesus' existence and lots of testimony and diverse testimony to what he did when he was alive. You have the four Gospels in our Bibles, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. You also have secular historians like Suetonius and others who testify to the existence of Jesus at that time. So there's very, very solid evidence for Jesus' existence. And the thing about the gospel writers is they're good historians. They keep anchoring the account into the world that they're in. They talk about who's the governor at the time, so that you can check those things. They talk about who's the leader, the chief priest at the time of Jesus walking in the earth. So you can check that. So you can keep checking all these other anchors to put Jesus there. When you get to the death and the resurrection, then what you're looking at is the same access to history with any historical event. You have testimony from lots of people that Jesus died. We know that the Romans were very good at killing people on crosses. They did it all the time. It wasn't a special thing just for Jesus. It was a common way of executing slaves or prisoners of war. And so once when Julius Caesar captured the pirates who were wrecking the Roman trade in the Mediterranean, he crucified all of them up and down the Appian Way, the big road leading into Rome, to let everybody know you don't mess with Caesar.
When that spear was put into Christ's side, doesn't the Bible say somewhere that blood and water came forth? And does that not suggest, if blood has been stationed for a while, obviously the red part of it sinks to the bottom and you're left with plasma at the top, so he's dead.
He's dead.
Unquestionably dead.
Absolutely. And the Bible also tells us that they broke Jesus' legs. And the reason they did that is because the way you died on a cross is horrific. You actually suffocated. So the idea is that to take a breath, because your body sags down under its own weight, to take a breath, you have to lift yourself up on the nails and push yourself up on the nails and the feet, and then you sag again, and you lift yourself up and you sag, and you do that in agonizing pain until your body can't do it anymore. To break the legs means that you can't push yourself up anymore. You can't take any breaths. And so that's another piece of evidence that he really died.